Welcome to the Future of Love teleseries presented by the Integral Spiritual Experience, Integral Life, and iEvolve Global Practice Community. The Future of Love dialogues continue this week with Sally Kempton dialoguing with Dr. Mark Goffney. Sally is recognized as a powerful meditation guide and is a spiritual teacher who integrates yogic philosophy with daily life. She is the author of The Heart of Meditation and writes the popular wisdom column for the Yoga Journal. Dr. Mark is a lineage holder of Kabbalah, a spiritual teacher of Kabbalah and world spirituality. He's a core founder of iEvolve Global Practice Community. Dr. Mark holds his doctorate from Oxford University and is a best-selling author with 7 books written and the forthcoming on Unique Self. In this dialogue, Sally and Mark will explore what it means to hold an evolutionary we space and the qualities of such a gathering. How does it deal with competition and jealousy? Who gets to lead? And what does it take to sustain it? It is with much pleasure that we present Sally Kempton and Dr. Mark Goffney.
Hello.
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 Hello, hello.
Sally Kempton. What a pleasure to hear your voice, Durgananda, Sally Kempton.
It's a pleasure
to be with you in the small we space that we're about to begin to talk about.
Yes. Yes,
yes,
exactly.
Yes.
And I understand that you're on the verge of a very exciting happening.
Yes, as a matter of fact, just to share with everyone, this is a delightful time. Mariana, my partner, is actually kind of about to go into labor. We won't share any of the details on the call. We thought she was actually in labor the night before and yesterday morning and at earlier times and later times in the morning, but it turned out not to be so. And all is quiet on the labor front on this Labor Day. I think today's Labor Day, isn't it? Or is it soon Labor Day? Or is it Monday?
No, today's Labor Day.
Is it Labor Day?
No, Monday's Labor Day.
Monday's Labor Day, but we're actually approaching Labor Day. So today is actually the due date.
Wow.
It's that day.
Wow.
It's that day. And Mariana was up and doing yoga this morning.
Fantastic.
I know. So blessings on that.
Blessings.
And delight. Yes.
Yes.
Send us your good blessings.
I send you every possible blessing and for the entrance into the great we space of your son.
Thank you very, very much. And we also got an email message from our good friend and partner in iEvolve, Global Practice Community, Diane Mushel-Hamilton, who's also my co-host dialogue right in this great series, The Future of Love. Welcome, everyone, right to The Future of Love. You know, we are here in... I'm not even sure what week it is. It must be the 23rd, 24th week. We've been going for a while and created just a wonderful we space of a certain form around this dialogue series. About 10,000 people signed up for the series, and people have been listening and really engaging in this very deep inquiry about what the future of love is all about and what it means and how we can be co-creative in unfolding, right, a future of love that really shifts and transforms, right, in the deepest ways, in the broadest ways, the way we talk to each other, the way we love each other, the way we hold each other, both in the realm of the personal, right, and in the realm of the transpersonal, in the realm of the collective, and in the realm of the individual. So it's just utterly delightful, you know, to be with you. And the topic today is the creation of an evolutionary we space. And just to kind of invite everyone into the particular topic, initially what Diane and I were going to talk to Sally about in the initial conception of the dialogue was the divine feminine, which is among many topics. It's one of them that you've taught about, Sally, extensively. And you know, we all know that you also incarnate. And then, you know, Sally said, you know, actually where I'm actually thinking and feeling these days is I'm really thinking a lot about this idea from the perspective of love of the evolutionary we space. So I want to just actually offer a bridge comment and then turn it over to you, Sally. In the great Kabbalistic tradition where I hold my kind of lineage reception, from which I have my transmission, from which I kind of live and breathe, there's a very beautiful teaching which says, Kol Asara, right, whenever 10 gather, right, whenever 10 people gather, Shchinta Sharya, right, the Shchina, the feminine goddess divine, right, there she dwells. That's very beautiful. Right, whenever,
very beautiful.
And, yeah, whenever 10, so what you got to have this notion that, right, that the Shchina herself, and actually in Kabbalah, the Shekhinah is called Knesset Yisrael, right? Literally the gathering of Israel, or that is to say the community, the we space. So the goddess divine, right, in the Kabbalistic tradition is itself the we space. So the intuition to talk about the goddess and to talk about the we space in some deep sense aren't different, but the we space is a face of the goddess. So just to begin, right, what's a we space? Right, talk to us from your perspective and from your deep teaching. And my job here is to do some occasional dialogue, but really to kind of hold the space so we can just hear your deep flowing wisdom. So we begin there. What is Sally Kempton? What is a we space?
Well, obviously, a we space on one level is whatever happens when a group of people are together. But the we space that I believe we're talking about here, the place where the divine feminine emerges, where the goddess arises, is in the subtle energy that shows up when there's genuine communion in a group of people. So a true we space, and this is something that I think many of us here have been exploring, both consciously, deliberately, and, shall we say, serendipitously throughout our lives as spiritual practitioners and enjoyers of evolutionary development. A true we space takes the participants into a place of shared awareness, shared love, where the contractions and, shall we say, the self-interested preoccupations of the individuals are able to dissolve, because the space that arises in the meeting of the group actually allows them to melt. And in a true we space, there's a kind of silent recognition of the consciousness that we all share. It often arises, as I said earlier, serendipitously. I often experience it, the arising of a we space, of the we space, of the consciousness of the, in the we space, kind of emerging like a kind of a cloud of energy that picks up a group of people, and, you know, and just allows us to be more than we are as individuals, to be in love with each other in a deeply impersonal but totally connected way. So the we space is a mystical space. It's a mystical awareness in which individual human beings recognize that in their individuality they're also totally connected.
Hmm.
So what I've discovered over the years, I think my first experience of the we space happened during a game of Capture the Flag when I was a kid. And
Capture
I think,
the Flag. Remember
the
that
flag
game.
Awesome. Did you ever play that game?
I did.
It's a great war and strategy game. And I think it's not an accident that, you know, that many of us have our first experience of the we space in team sports. Also, of course, in, you know, in kind of bonding situations in war. It's one of the places where the we space seems to arise, strangely enough. But in this particular moment, you know, I was with a group of about 10 kids, and we were running around, chasing each other up and down the field, capturing the flag. And suddenly, out of nowhere, this vastness arose in which all of us were contained, and there was a kind of an unspoken recognition among all of us, that, you know, that we were together, you know, in a kind of movement, a flow. And the normal competition of grabbing the flag and tagging each other, etc., it all went on. But it went on with a sense of just huge love and communion. And I actually, in that, you know, it became one of the major memories of my childhood, that, you know, that shared consciousness space. We never talked about it. It never happened again. You know, our normal mm-hmm. games of the Capture the Flag were, you know, the kind of rough and tumble that the games often are. But what I found in my early life and throughout my life as a teacher is that in those moments when a group becomes a we, when the, you know, let's say the goddess arises in the space of communion, it feels as though every single person in the group enters essence, you know, enters their true self. and you know, and the actions and the words and the flow of energy in the group seems to come from a place that's so beyond the individuals that you know that it's totally mystical, and yet has absolute space for each individual to be what they are. So
wow.
That's,
so let's start there. You've just said so much, and there's so much we can go in. So I want to just, with your permission, just gently pause for a second and try and kind of just feel into just the richness and the tapestry that you just unfolded before us. So first, just to kind of feel into this space that you've described, which is where ego falls to the wayside, and this larger field, this vastness was the word that you used, right, kind of, you know, emerges, and you feel yourself, you know, in this larger space. And one of the things that just kind of struck me is you said that no one talked about it, right? It's that,
right.
That these experiences often, you know, happen, and we often don't talk about them. And sometimes, you know, had you not gone on to intense spiritual practice, it might even have receded from your memory, and you not even have recognized what it was. But that actually people can actually, that we need to kind of collect these experiences and let them guide us, because sometimes they happen because there's no language to name them. We actually don't realize that we're having a genuine mystical experience.
Right, right. Absolutely.
You know?
And, you know, one of the very interesting things that I think we all find these days is that in rock concerts, in peace demonstrations, you know, in group gatherings of many kinds, there will be moments like that when the group kind of rises into this exalted state. And I believe that this is actually what people seek in groups, you know, unconsciously. It's what we really are looking for is that merging into a collective essence that, you know, that shows us our connection with each other.
So I want to actually go into that with you, with your permission, Sally, into kind of what people seek in groups. But I want to kind of just delay for a second, because that's going to take us down a very gorgeous rabbit hole. I'm just thinking, just kind of staying with your initial beautiful offering and its richness. I'm thinking about remember the basketball coach Phil Jackson, right? Remember he brought, I think, I don't know if you're I don't imagine that you're a sports fan, but maybe your brothers are. Right, or I don't know if your father was a sports fan, or you have friends who are sports fans, right? The L.A. Lakers and Chicago Bulls went to multiple championships, and he writes about what happened on the team, kind of a more expanded version of your Capture the Flag story. He writes about what he calls the subtle interweaving of the players at full speed to the point where they were thinking and moving as one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I mean that exact experience, you know, and that something happens in that experience, you know, which is very, very powerful. And there's a sense of, and I think what you said is, we began by naming this as the goddess, right? That this is in some sense that experience of being part of this larger, and that almost sensual experience, that almost, you know, Eros and Plato's sense of Eros in the Symposium, when Plato describes kind of becoming part of, you know, the great dialogue in the community, right? It is actually in some sense a taste of the goddess,
yeah.
Right, of what she's holding.
Yeah, I would say more than a taste of the goddess, it is actually the experience of the goddess, of the Shakti, of the life force, which, you know, moving through all of us as one. So that every individual's gifts, talents, skills, inspiration, is both magnified by, you know, by the collective energy, and also serves the collective energy.
This is very important. So let me just repeat that sentence you just said. So one of the demarcating characteristics of what we might call, if we can, an authentic evolutionary we space is, and I want to quote you back to yourself and ask you to expand on it, right, is that every individual both kind of rises beyond themselves and lives in this larger space, and at the same time, right, the capacities of every individual are actually not minimized, right, they're not obliterated, they're not overrun, but they're actually, the words you use were magnified, right, and expanded. So it seems that you're talking about a very particular kind of we space, because of course we know that if you're at a kind of Hitler mass rally, you know, in Nuremberg, right, or in Munich, you know, at the square there, you're actually also participating in a we space.
Yes, exactly. And this is a really important distinction, because let's say a we space that happens at a lower level of consciousness, at a pre-personal level of consciousness,
exactly,
normally means that the individuals in the group kind of lose their individuality and get, you know, and get sucked into a, you know, a kind of a mob experience, if you will, you know, which has its, which is, of course, has its excitement and its particular joy, but
well,
it's very definitely.
Let's not knock mobs on a good day.
Let's not knock mobs.
Okay. But the distinction, the distinction is so critical.
The distinction is absolutely critical. And, you know, and I, obviously human beings seek collective experience, right? You know, we love to join. But on a pre-personal level, when we join, we lose ourselves. And lose ourselves not in the best sense of the word, but, you know, but lose ourselves, lose our, for example, our individual ethics, the boundaries of normal behavior. So you have, mobs after football games, you know, kind of smashing bars and smashing each other.
Right. You were once arrested for being in a mob after a football game, you know, smashing some bars. Is that a true story? No,
it was a mob after a peace demonstration.
So let me stay with this set of distinctions, Sally, that you're drawing for us, so which, of course, in integral consciousness are so essential. So you're drawing distinction between pre-personal, right, between a we space, which is actually regressive, which
right,
kind of moves back to what you've labeled, you know, the pre-personal, right? And the nature of the pre-personal, as you're expressing it, is that the personal is lost, right? It's pre-personal. You lose, right, the individuated autonomy of the glorious ego, you know, in the best sense of, you know, the autonomous self. And that we space actually creates in its wake what you just called the violation of ethics, you know, on all the levels of personal ethics. And yet, right, as you say, and again, I'm just trying to, you know, I live, as I mentioned in the last few dialogues since I've moved to Marin, I live in Marin County, so all we do back here is we reflect things. So I'm just trying to reflect, right, you know, back in what you said, just so we can kind of capture it, right? There's a violation of ethics, right? There's a violation of personal ethics, and as you said, there's an attraction to it.
Can
right,
I, yes.
Please.
I would say, of what you're saying is absolutely right, except I would say it's not necessarily a violation of ethics. What I would say is that it opens the possibility of a violation
right,
of ethics.
That's right. That's right. You know, the pre-personal, right, invites us to violate the personal.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, or simply to lose the personal.
Well,
so,
no, let me,
you know,
let me think of that word lose, because you talked about that word lose before. So you said before, you said we lose ourselves when we go
yeah,
to the pre-personal, but your exact phrase was we lose ourselves, but not at our best, which just kind of brings in, you just used the phrase again, that actually paradoxically, right, the word, you know, to lose myself actually is neutral, right?
Yeah.
And we want to lose ourselves in a great opera, right, in great lovemaking, in great study, but we can also lose ourselves in the pre-personal. So losing ourselves seems to be a great goal of the human being, right? And yet, is it a transpersonal goal or is it a pre-personal goal? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And it's entirely a question of the level of consciousness in which you're operating. And I think so. Here comes the question, which maybe we don't want to go into at this moment, of what is the level of consciousness of the group.
Oh, fantastic! So I mean, first off, we go into whatever you want to. You are the guest, and I'm the humble facilitator. So you guide the way, and I'm following your we space, right? So there's a slight, you know, I'm going to follow your track. What is the level of consciousness in the group? In other words, what is the internal experience of a we space, which is actually transpersonal, which is actually this beautiful collective consciousness, which is actually this exalted, you know, goddess state, right? What is that level of consciousness?
Okay, beautifully said. So what I would say, first of all, is that the characteristic of an evolutionary or transpersonal or, you know, if you will, higher consciousness we space is that the group has gathered together for a purpose that is in its core transpersonal, and you know, my great mentor in these
mm-hmm,
these matters was a tantric sage called Abhinavagupta, who was both a master of non-dual realization. He was also an aesthetician. he wrote a kind of seminal treatise on aesthetics. And
Abhinavagupta wrote a treatise on aesthetics. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is still taught in drama schools today.
Wow. Well, Abhinavagupta, for those of you who are not familiar, right, is the great, kind of one of the originating masters of Kashmir Shaivism, which is the tradition out of which Sally Kempton teaches, right, and is considered one of, like, maybe, Ken said to me in a casual conversation, he thought he was one of the 10 greatest masters who ever lived. So he's one of the great, 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 great non-dual realized masters in whose lineage, right, from that grace Sally teaches. So please, Sally, just a bracket there. So Abhinavagupta, please.
Abhinavagupta, who was a radically integral master. In other words, he was a master not just of spirituality, but of art, of group dynamics. And Abhinavagupta's one of the ways he functioned and taught was through something called the tantric circle, the tantric chakra. In the tantric traditions, spiritual practice is always done in groups. It's done in groups that are held to a certain number, different numbers in different circles. And the idea is that the group in the circle comes together for spiritual awareness, that everybody in the group is completely dedicated to spiritual awareness, and that, and that their focus is practice. So their focus is not on, on hooking up with other members of the circle. Their focus isn't on competition. There's no kind of egoic gain, at least not ideally, to be had in the circle. And everybody in the group offers their awareness, their attention, their focus, their love, as it were, to the shared goal. And one of the things that Abhinavagupta said that I've always found almost spine-cricklingly relevant in group situations, he says that when a group is one-pointedly focused on a single goal, whether it's a spiritual goal or a dance performance or a performance of music, when their attention as a group is totally merged. And he was talking here about dance and music that had a spiritual quality to it, because that was the context in which he lived. That consciousness, shakti, awareness, which is normally contracted, which normally becomes dense and diverse in different bodies, that consciousness automatically expands in the group. And the group is able to enter into the experience of, as I said earlier, of the full unfolding of the consciousness that is everything. So he would say that the secret is the one-pointedness and dedication of the members to the goal. He also would say that if any member of the group has has taken himself or herself outside the group with anger, with jealousy, with selfish aims, then the unity of the group is destroyed and consciousness can't expand. So I would say that the two characteristics of an evolutionary we space are, first of all, a real commitment to a shared goal, to a shared evolutionary goal, and a willingness and an ability of the participants to let go of their neuroticism, and of their selfish aims within the circle.
So beautiful. I mean, that's just so completely gorgeous. And thank you, Abhinavagupta, and thank you for the channel of grace in Sally, and just bringing this, to the table here. And let's just kind of try and capture it. So there's two characteristics that you're describing from both the perspective of your own experience realization and, receiving the teaching of Abhinavagupta, right? And we're, of course, naturally interpolating our evolutionary context, right, into the conversation, because we're calling this an evolutionary we space, which wasn't a term, of course, that Abhinavagupta would have used, although in other conversations that we've had, Sally, dialogues, we've talked about, how Kashmir Shaivism and evolutionary thought kind of dance with each other. But let's bracket that for a second. So part of what creates an evolutionary we space, which is genuinely, authentically, beautiful, the goddess space, is the goal, right, is the intention, right? And as you add it in, right, it has to be an evolutionary intention, because of course the mob going to lynch someone is actually linked together in the frenzy of single-pointed focus, which is to lynch, right, the man. You know, often, you know, in the South, you know, bell hooks has just, you know, horrific, you know, descriptions of, you know, women making false complaints of sexual advances, right, in which, you know, black men were hung and lynched, you know, regularly. And she describes the ferocity of the kind of masculine one-pointed direction, you know, kind of movement, you know, in the ferocity of the mob, you know, the shadow of the goddess, right, in this we space. So it's not enough for there to be a focus and a goal, you say. It has to be an evolutionary goal. And an evolutionary goal meaning for the expansion of consciousness, for the expansion of circles of caring and concern, for the deepening of loving. So that's one characteristic. And I want to focus and ask you some questions about the second one. And the second characteristic that you're bringing into our conversation is the ability of members of the circle, right, to let go of their own, you called it neuroticism, you know, their own fears. And so let me just ask a question. You know, it seems, you know, let me give you a Jewish context for the question. You know, we're coming up on Rosh Hashanah, which is the, in the Hebrew calendar, the new year. And of course, every great, you know, calendar has its new year. And after the new year is Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, you know, when we ask forgiveness. And it just, I've been thinking the last couple of years, the scene has always kind of goes through my head. It's almost like a Kafkaesque scene, where you'll go into like every, you know, major synagogue, you know, that actually follows the tradition, Sally, and you'll see people asking each other forgiveness. You know, people go over to each other like before prayer started, will you forgive me? Will you forgive me? But of course, what's happening is all the people who have done nothing to each other, right, you know, are asking each other for forgiveness, right, in this kind of ecstasy of piety, when actually the real people that have hurt each other, you know, who really need to ask forgiveness in a real way, you know, are still locked in their fear and locked in their neurosis and locked in all the things that prevent people from asking forgiveness. You know, and so to really be in a we space, to let go of neuroticism and fear, it seems like that's a very, very hard thing to do, right? Because you really have to touch not the pseudo-fears. You know what I mean? And there's a place where a pseudo-community comes together and we let go of our pseudo-fears. You really have to go, I mean, perhaps you don't, I mean, as a question, you have to actually touch like that deep place where you really can let the contracted fear and neurosis uncoil, and that's very hard. How do you do that? How do you facilitate that? How do you foster that, right, in a community? I know that you do that in your teaching communities. So how does that happen? What's some of the path here?
Well, I would say that there are several different levels of it. You know, just as, again, you know, when we understand that evolution is there's always different quadrants in which we have to operate, right? So there's one level in which in an evolutionary we space, in a, you know, if there's a genuine transmission going on in the space, then there's an energy, there's a love energy, there's an expansion energy which will naturally kind of melt divisions in the moment. You know, so in other words, the part of the context of such a group is that there should be a genuine transmission going on. There should be a space of Shakti, a goddess holding space. You know, I think one of the ways that we both define the divine feminine is as a kind of spaciousness, a container that yes, gives a kind of absolute loving permission for people to be as they are, and to allow both their differences and their stuckness to melt in that moment. So you need that context. In other words, you need the space of the Divine Mother to kind of hold, in her vast subtle womb, all the flawed humanness that we may bring to the table. And given that space, which I would say is perhaps the ultimate safe space, you know, we always talk about in therapeutic situations, we need a safe space, a space of unconditional personal regard. That Sorry, I just read this email from Kelly, which distracted me for a moment. Took me out of the shared respace. So,
okay, so that, Sally, to turn off the email.
Yeah. Good idea.
You thought it was an instruction that we needed for the dialogue. No. I actually knew that you must have been reading something. That's exactly what happens when you get distracted from the we space. Then you lose actually the shakti, right?
Exactly. So we just got a demonstration of
right,
what happens.
Exactly.
We get distracted. So this space of unconditional personal regard, which you know can occur between two individuals, also occurs as the shakti of the we space kind of expands in the group. And I want to
before, if you can hold that with your permission, with a deep bow for a second, I just want to just hold and you know what you've said, because you've said so much. And again, my kind of job here is to kind of actually be in the masculine form of creating just a moment of a container boundary, perhaps a feminine, just to kind of hold, you know, the jewels that you're dropping on us. So I want to just catch a couple of words that you said, Sally, and reflect them back. Is that okay? And then we can try and kind of deepen in that space before we move on. Does that work for you?
Totally.
Okay. So you talked about three different characteristics, right, of the we space, which are critical, right, in order to allow the second major quality, which is, right, which is necessary for the we space to emerge, which is the letting go of ego. Which is the letting
go
of neurosis. That's what we're talking about. It's just, so everyone, just to, for everyone to kind of gather with us around, you know, beautiful, beautiful people who are listening. So we're talking about, Sally was describing the two qualities of an evolutionary we space, which is shared direction and purpose, particularly shared evolutionary direction and purpose, number one. Right, number two, the ability to let go of the kind of egoic contraction, right, to let go of the neurosis, right, which is always motivated by a kind of deep fear. So then, in that context, Sally has described for us three different characteristics, three different, you know, ways, right, necessary elements, right, that create that ability to let go, right, of that coiled egoic contraction. One was transmission. There has to be a transmission into the space, right? The goddess is both kind of transmitting to the space and holding the space, which happens either the transmission that the group is giving to itself or often happens through a teacher. It's a transmission from a teacher, from a person who's actually facilitating the space that actually at least initiates the space. You know, at that point, the space may then, you know, become self-propelling, but the space often requires a kind of initiating energy. So that's one, a transmission, right? Two, right, it has to be a safe space. And the transmission helps create the radically safe space, but there's a requirement to actually create, you know, safety in the space. So those are really the two major things. And what you said, what that does is, the word you used was, it melts the divisions.
Right.
That was your beautiful phrase, meaning you're not doing an actual therapeutic process. You're not untying the knot, you know, from, you know, using that yogic phrase, but actually you're just burning the knot away. It's gone.
Exactly. Exactly. Beautiful. So, and what I would say here is given that we are multi-level beings, mm-hmm. and that certain fears, contractions, jealousies, you know, like, jealousy especially being something that comes up majorly in groups, that there also needs to be something within the group that allows these qualities to kind of be brought out, offered into the space, admitted, you know, kind of copped to, in an environment which doesn't make them wrong. So that we actually can, by bringing awareness to these qualities in the group, melt them. So this is what I would call the element of, perhaps we could call it spiritual therapeutics.
Right. You've added something here. So in other words, initially you were describing melting the divisions, in which the power of the expanded shakti itself melts the division. Now you've added a dimension in which actually you're actually interpolating, if you will, a Western, you know, therapeutic modality into actually creating in the space the awareness, putting some of these qualities, putting some of the fears, right, putting some of the knots and the contractions in the space so that you can actually consciously melt them.
Exactly. And I would say this is, you know, we're talking about an evolutionary we space. This is an element that modernity has recognized and, you know, and begun to incorporate into the traditional, you know, way of creating we space. You know, in the tradition, we simply offered ourselves into the space, and the space held us and purified us, transformed us. And, you know, and we did our own personal work to bring contracted elements into awareness, which, of course, we all have to do. Any really evolutionary we space needs to, the members of that group need to be very, very serious about, bringing awareness to their own stuff, right?
Right.
Otherwise, it just, kind of, it sort of uncontrollably comes out into the group. But I would say there's a certain structure of a we space, a certain kind of group consciousness in which it is actually possible in a formal, almost, let's say, ritualized way to bring those elements of fear and anger and jealousy into the group, to state them and to allow the group to hold them in awareness so that they literally lose their charge. And I want to give an example of the first spiritual group that I was ever in years and years and years ago had a process, and I think that, this kind of thing operates in, it's not an uncommon process today in groups where there's a high level of trust. And in this group, we worked together. We didn't only do spiritual work together. We actually had, a shared, shall we say, mission. We taught together. We created, learning spaces together. So it was obviously very important, that the transmission that we held in common be very pure, very clear. And we used to do a process which we called karma cleaning.
In
which,
karma cleaning.
Yeah, which I think is a great phrase.
Mm-hmm.
In which this group of people who trusted each other, who were committed to each other, would sit in a group. It was a limited group. It would be 7 or 9 people, and we would go around the circle, and everybody would say, a charge or an issue that they had with somebody else, and the idea was that the person would speak the charge. Would speak it not as a "I hate you because you did this," but would say in a way that it's a modality that's actually used today in Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent
communication. Right,
yeah.
Communication.
Yeah, and you would say, when you did this, blah 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 blah, I felt this, and everybody would listen, and then we would go on to the next person. And what would happen, again, because of the group energy, because of the group holding, is that many of the, a lot of the charge that would be there in the incident would be kind of burned by the speaking of it. And when it wasn't, there would then be a conversation back and forth within the context of the group, with the group holding the intention that the conversation would be held non-defensively, without defending or attacking, and the group would be present and conscious to make sure that didn't happen. And what I found, as a kind of fledgling, spiritual practitioner in that group was that all kinds of qualities and issues of distrust and, that I had hidden and held inside, when they came out in the group, when they were spoken in the group, in an atmosphere in which people, we really had a contract with each other not to hold these things against each other. In other words, not to bring them up and throw them in each other's faces later on. So that there was a sense that everybody really knew each other, everybody really held each other, everybody was committed to each other, and everybody was committed to bringing out and speaking the things that held them back. And the combination of the space of transmission and the mutual honesty in a context of holding was enormously transformative. And we didn't have to analyze it, and we didn't have to talk about our past. We didn't have to talk about our childhood. We simply had to bring these feelings into awareness and hold them in awareness for them to melt. And in my experience, to melt on a very deep level, there were things that I had held for years that lost their power for me in those groups. So that's one of the great things that an evolutionary group can do is is help each other, you know, melt contraction.
That's completely beautiful, and I want to kind of really go in with you to a few of the things that you said, but I just heard your email click, so I am demanding on behalf of the Future of Love that your email is off because we want the full goddess with us. Because isn't that interesting? I hear the little email click, right? You know, we all have like email in the background, and one of the things that just is so hard for us to do is to actually find, and that's why, you know, having a group is so important, that we really get out of our, you know, our lives, you know, into the center of the group, right?
Yes.
And kind of the group really holds us in this way. So let's just look at and reflect back to everyone. What did Sally really do now? She just really, you know, in this very seamless and graceful way, you know, made a very dramatic integral move, right? And brought together, right, you know, kind of the best modalities of the Western psychological tradition with, you know, Abhinavagupta, right, and the deep transmissions, right, of the goddess we space, and this is precisely what we mean by an evolutionary we space. And as the nature of the we space we're describing is evolutionary because it's actually in an integral embrace, you know, bringing together transmission, right, you know, authentic, genuine transmission, right, in a real way, you know, a goddess space in a real way, right, it's the deep quality and texture and richness, right, of the goddess that's holding the space, the holding environment in its most, you know, dramatic form. And at the same time, you know, the actual conscious putting into the center of the group that which needs to be melted, right, in a very tantric kind of way. You actually bring it, right, into the space. You bring feeling into it. You bring attention to it, right, without judging it, without trying to solve it. And it by itself, right, in a very deep way, right, is subject to healing. So bringing these two modalities together, right, is very powerful and very necessary. And we need to be able to use them together. So I want to kind of pose a problem. Let me be a problem person for a second. How does a person, you know, what is it? Let me say it this way. What is it about the group? I'm thinking out loud with you. What is it about the group, you know, that allows a person to really melt their fear, to melt their contraction? So let me just offer something and then turn it back to you, Sally. You know, on the one hand, it seems like, you know, the group itself just actually calls people to their highest self simply through exposing to the light of day, you know, the foibles and the pettinesses and the contractions and the tantrums that a person, you know, would rather do in private. You know, I think in a very simple elemental way, you know, when you're in a group, you're actually called to be, you know, your best self. You know, you're called to be the person that you'd like to be, you'd like to hear described on the day of your funeral. You know, that kind of private, hidden, contracted pettiness, right, just by shining light on it, just by itself, right, something dissipates. That's one piece of it. But it seems to me that there's a second quality of the group, which is actually the Shakti of the group. It's not just the group embarrasses me into being my highest self, but there's actually a genuine force of Shakti that you and I have both felt so many times in teaching, right, where the Shakti itself, you know, it's like the intelligent prana in yoga terms, which if you actually access it, is healing in and of itself. And is there a way, can you speak to that a little bit from your teaching, from your experience? You know, what is it in the Shakti, right, in the prana, which is not precisely the same as the Shakti, so I'm using the words, you know, loosely for those of you who are rigorous, right, what is that healing quality? Can we dip into it for a second?
Well, one of the classic ways that we describe Shakti as it operates in the human sphere is that it's the energy that returns things to their source. You know, the source being consciousness itself.
Yeah.
The source. So when you actually bring in whatever you offer into Shakti, when it's fully expanded, it, you know, will be kind of automatically transmuted and kind of return to its very subtle essence. And the way I sometimes experience it, okay, now we're in the realm of subtle magic here, you know, the kind of indescribable vibrational quality of reality, that let's say, you know, a feeling of anger, which is a very dense feeling, right? It's, you know, it's got a kind of burning quality to it. It's filled with, you know, a sense of sort of righteousness, and it just wants to get out and express itself, right? So you bring that feeling of anger to consciousness, and you offer it into the Shakti, into the, you know, in, let's say, into the group energy, not as an outburst, right, but as a, you know, as a heartfelt statement of a feeling. And what will happen is that it's as if the particles, if you will, of this very subtle light energy, which is the energy of the Shakti in the group, will infuse the dense feeling, and there will be a liberation of the feeling. There will be an opening of the density of that feeling, and it will dissolve. It will melt. Very often, what it leaves behind, you know, as we know, when dense emotions melt, what happens is that they liberate, you know, the energy behind them, the energy that's been locked up into them. So, in a certain sense, by offering, you know, offering your stuff into the we space, it sort of allows the Shakti to fill up the, you know, the space that's left, you know, when that dense emotion dissolves. So Mark, would you like to offer another, you know, understanding or experience of how this happens?
Well, I think just first I'm just kind of sitting with your unpacking of it, which is so beautiful, and the experience of, you know, and really the way I'm listening now is actually as I'm listening, I'm fully intent on listening to you. So I'm not in thinking about what I'm going to say while you're talking. I just want to kind of be in the space of what you're saying. And the word, you know, it's actually very beautiful when you're in the space of what someone's saying and not actually using their talking to think about what you're going to say. So your memory is also crystal clear. So one of the reasons I remember clearly what you say, right, is because I'm so in the space of it and so delighting in it. So I think you began with the phrase that Shakti is the energy that brings things back to their source.
Right.
You know, right, and just what a beautiful just understanding of Shakti, you know, the very mechanism of Shakti, you know, it brings us back to the Garden of Eden. You know, it brings us back to the original place, you know, and again I hark back again that, you know, when we do that and also deploy at the same time the most advanced evolutionary modalities of the Western psychology, you know, when those merge together, right, you get actually a very, very powerful, you know, evolutionary technology, right, which is so, you know, absolutely necessary for us. And you described it as kind of the subtle magic, I think was your word, right, of the Shakti. And this subtle magic is alive in the boardroom today, you know, in America today. You know, one of the things that we're seeing is that this subtle magic, as it were, right, is being accessed, you know, more and more in the very commodified, you know, room of the boardroom, you know, and one of the reasons is that people are feeling, right, that a new wisdom, a new content, new understanding, new spaces of insight are opened up, you know, through this process that once we've actually created this we space that you've described in such eloquent terms, Sally, right, what actually emerges is not only a feeling of being held by the goddess, not only a feeling of expansion, not only a feeling of one's highest self, part of the larger, you know, field of being, the seamless code of the universe in which we live, not only is that realization there, but actually that realization has it's not only an experience of realization, the realization has content.
Yeah.
And I want to perhaps turn in that direction now. It seems like a natural segue, right, which is, you know, to talk about what's created, what's the content that's created, right, what's the wisdom that's created in the, and just to answer your turning to me for a kind of new piece of content, but in this direction with your permission, in the ancient, you know, Hebrew study hall, right, the Beit Midrash, right, the essence was the study hall in which people engaged in what, you know, you might call in Buddhism Dharma combat, right, but the Dharma combat was egoless, meaning it wasn't about posturing, it wasn't about looking charming, it wasn't about saying something funny and hearing everyone, you know, it wasn't about, you know, feeling, you know, the you know, feeling intoxicated and having your anxiety soothed because you've said something penetrating and insightful. It wasn't about any of that, right? The essence of the study hall was to create a space, right, in which the Shekhinah danced. They would say the Shekhinah, right, the Shekhinah that spoke in Moses spoke in every master in the study hall, right? The ego was literally left behind and out of the space of, you know, true self, you know, where as you said, the divisions had been melted, right? This new wisdom emerged because the new wisdom emerged from the wisest, you know, the most profound, you know, authentic, you know, unique selves, right, that danced together there in the study hall, and the entire enterprise of the Talmud, right, and of the Kabbalah, right, is based on the Kabbalah. The Zohar, for example, the major book of Hebrew mysticism, is written by a group of people who accessed, right, this evolutionary we space. And the descriptions of the writing of the Zohar is this group space that was created. You know, the transmission was given into the space by Shimon Bar Yochai, but then the group intelligence yielded the Zohar. That actually the great Kabbalistic and Talmudic documents are yielded. The wisdom, right, is yielded by this, what you called subtle magic. So it's both realization and, right, the unfolding of the next stages of wisdom and knowing how to solve problems in the world and knowing how to, right, comes directly from the space. And in that sense, it's utterly essential, literally for the next stage of the planet's perhaps even very survival.
Yeah, totally, totally. And, you know, and I would say that one of the beautiful things in the West about the fact that people in science and people in business and, you know, people who are acting very powerfully in the world have had some degree of spiritual training and an entrance into these spaces in spiritual context, recognize how much wisdom is able to arise when a group is turned together towards a very high goal and are actually able to bring it into so-called mundane life. You know, so that one of the kind of pioneers in this arena, as in my understanding, was David Bohm, the physicist.
David Bohm, yes, absolutely.
Who is also, as you probably know, a student of Krishnamurti, he called this process, this spontaneous process that can emerge in groups and bring forth new ideas. He called it dialogue. The idea being that a group of people would sit around with a problem or an issue or an intention to move to a new understanding and a dialogue would take place which would just kind of emerge in a spontaneous way, sort of in the middle of the group, out of the interaction of the group. I think we've all been in those groups. You have to have a tape recorder running because you know, very often that what happens is that everybody climbs into a kind of essential space and things are said that are way beyond what the individuals in the group are capable of saying or understanding.
I'm just delighting with you.
It's actually the most fun in the world, I think. It's my favorite thing.
The most fun, and, you know, in the deepest sense of fun, right? Not the surface fun, but just the depth of, and, you know, there was a gentleman, Sally, named, there is a gentleman, his name is, I had a lovely couple of lunches with him in Cambridge a few years back, named Bill Isaacs. And Bill, if you're listening, it's good to be with you again, even on the phone space. And Bill runs a company called Dialogos. And he actually studied with Bohm. And Dialogos means actually meaning moving through, you know, from the word dialogue, you know, which was so essential to Bohm's, you know, teaching, you know, influenced both by physics and by Krishnamurti. Dialogos, meaning moving through. And what Bill does in this company, Dialogos, is he actually works in the field of organizational change, right, to bring to, you know, Fortune 500 companies, right, you know, the beginnings of technologies, you know, that allow this to happen, which can actually create, you know, a kind of wisdom that we need. We need this wisdom to, you know, not only to build a Fortune 500 company, which creates jobs and hopefully goodness if it's run ethically, but we need it to solve world hunger.
Yeah.
You know, we need it to kind of break out of the crisis of imagination that, you know, doesn't allow us to be able to reimagine a world. And I want to just read you a description, Sally. I was a number of years ago, and then turn it back to you because everyone who's with us, just notice we've now shifted into the next part of the conversation. Right, we're talking now about not just not only the realization that emerges from this evolutionary we space, right, the realization of true self, the realization of true self that happens in the collective we space, but the wisdom, you know, the wisdom that moves through. So here's just a quote describing it, and I want to cite the quote. When I was a few years ago at the Synthesis Dialogues, you know, with the Dalai Lama, met a bunch of great friends there, and one of them was a young man who was then writing for What Is Enlightenment magazine and is now teaching, Craig Hamilton, and he had written an article on collective intelligence. And he forwarded me that article, so I want to read from it and just credit him with collecting this particular quote. So it says, it's a quote from a corporate seminar, right, describing this collective we space. So, quote, when someone else spoke, it felt as if I were speaking. When I did speak, it was almost egoless, like it wasn't really me. It was as if something larger was speaking through me. And in that space, we started to create. We started to say things that we had never thought before. It's almost as if when someone would speak, something would become illuminated, something would become revealed, and that would open up something else to become revealed. You know, and this beautiful description, end of quote, you know, of this process.
Gorgeous.
Mm. Yeah, isn't it?
Totally, totally gorgeous. Yeah, and it really is as though Source speaks. You know, so, and we, of course, we realize in that moment that we have this potential, that we actually could live in that space of completely open awareness where our minds have become one and we can allow that one mind to speak through many voices in the room. And it's not just passing the talking stick. That's the thing. You know, we often
that's critical, right? It's not just the new age pass the talking stick, which is a kind of pseudo we space, which is kind of facile and saccharine, and the distinction is no new wisdom ever emerges from it.
Right, exactly. So, and yet it's an attempt to create the we space. It
intuits that there's something possible, but it doesn't know how to do it because there's no Shakti and there's no transmission and there's no appropriate hierarchy. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. So this is a critical distinction. It's a critical distinction, and the idea of appropriate hierarchy, which is of course a big subject on its own. You know, that because so much of what allows a group to enter this place is good facilitation. You know, simply because the strongest energy in the room tends to prevail, right? So if there's someone facilitating with a powerful intention for that space to arise and the capacity to, you know, to kind of hold the attention of the group so that it can enter that space, that's probably the easiest way for this kind of expanded wisdom we space to arise. So, you know, a good facilitator is a huge help.
And a good facilitator who's willing actually, right, to give a transmission, you know, into the room, which is genuine. And it just again, for everyone listening, just notice this new distinction that's actually emerged. You know, we're not talking about, as Sally says, you know, passing the talking stick. You know, passing a talking stick is a kind of leveling of differences, right, which happens. Everyone gets to talk for the same amount of time. Whatever they say, you know, and then the next person talks, and there's something very lovely about it, you know, but it really happens at what we might call an integral speak. And when we describe levels of consciousness, at the green level of consciousness, which is this kind of, you know, where this kind of multicultural, pluralistic, radically non-hierarchical, non-distinction-making, non-discerning of different levels of quality reigns, and you get this feeling which actually is very bland. You know, there's a certain point, you know, you walk into kind of a Marin County gathering, you know, they're about to, you know, go around the circle. There's a kind of dreariness at this point that descends on the room because everyone knows that we're going to have a kind of complete blanding and blending in which we're actually blinded, right, to depth. And this is not what we're talking about, right, in the creation of an evolutionary we space. We're actually, paradoxically, and I want to introduce this and throw it back at you or throw it or gently pass it back to you. It seems like essential to evolutionary we space is unique self.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's completely essential. And that means that the people in the group, and here's the tricky part, the people in the group have to be qualified to be there in order for this
right.
to happen.
Right.
I mean, that's not always true because there's, you know, there's the serendipitous arising of, you know, of this magical space. It happens in workshops quite a lot. You know, just the process of being in a workshop with a group of people over a weekend will create that space. But if we're talking about a group of people intentionally working together in an evolutionary we space over time, there has to be a real equality in the members, in the sense that each one of them has to have access to the unique self. So, you know, so that means that they do have to have worked through a lot of the barriers. They have to be willing to throw the barriers, up in the moment when they arise, you know, not to be stopped by them. They have to have a strong true self experience, a strong ability to enter into essence, and they have to have, to be able to kind of flow seamlessly, between the kind of essential place of silence and stillness, and the kind of conversation that can arise when stillness there in the room.
Yeah, this seems to be, precisely, it seems to be so essential because let's just look at it for a second. Actually, when we really feel into it, we realize that an evolutionary we space can arise neither exclusively from the place of separate self, ego, personality, or from the classical enlightenment space of true self, that neither of those can actually foster an evolutionary we space. The ego can't foster it, because the best the ego can do is pretend like it's not there and create this kind of facile, saccharine, pseudo-we space, but really it's just the kind of very, very wise strategic manipulations of the ego, posturing, right, in its spiritual form, right? So the ego can't do it. The true self can't do it, because the true self, the total number of true selves is one. True self is about, becoming part of the seamless code of the universe, and you lose yourself, you're absorbed in the true self, so there's not much that you have to say which is distinct and unique. It's only the unique self that emerges from the true self, which is the perspective of true self, right, which is freed, which is liberated from the grasping of ego. It's actually the meeting of a community of unique selves that actually creates evolutionary we space.
Yeah, beautiful. And let's just come back for a minute to the early part of our conversation, Mark. So,
please.
So what I would say here is that the we space we were talking about in the beginning is a shared true self space. So that, in other words, the source energy, the Shakti that allows the space to emerge is coming purely out of true self, and then in the expression of it, in the stepping into the space and allowing wisdom or problem solving or just kind of new levels of understanding to emerge, that's where the unique self arises. So actually, I would say a true we space is both a true self space, to use the terms that we've been working with in the last couple of years and in the integral spiritual experience, and also a unique self space. Does that make sense?
That's perfect sense, right? It's got to be the unique self has to emerge from true self. If there's not genuine, and that, of course, as we've talked about so many times, right, unique self can't emerge unless there's actually a genuine realization of true self. You can have glimmerings of unique self before, which is why in the Shakti created in a workshop, at any level of consciousness, a glimmering of unique self can emerge, just like it does, in a flow state. But for the full sustained evolutionary we space to emerge, right, that actually requires unique self. So let's open up something else here. This is a good place to go into, what do we need to do to create, and I want to make a distinction here, Sally, to create not just a spontaneous and temporary, right, we space, but what we might call a sustained we space. In other words, a community of students. I know that what I'm starting to try and do with my students, but just at the very beginning, right, to create a sense of continuity, and we're far from being there, but that it's certainly the intention, right, is to actually create a community of students, and a community of, student friends, and, where we together can over time, right, create a kind of collective intelligence, of the community itself, which is a very powerful thing to do. Our colleague Andrew Cohen has done a lot of work, right, in this particular kind of modality. And the Beit Midrash, as I said earlier, the study hall of Hebrew mysticism, is all based on, a sustained, we space, which actually produced the Talmud, right? So both from your tradition, from the Abhinavagupta tradition, from your, you have an enormous amount of experience, you know, perhaps more than anyone in our contemporary integral space, you know, with being part of large spiritual communities, both in, you know, in leadership roles, right, and in disciple roles, you know, over the years. So share with us, how is that done? How do you create, you know, not just in a workshop, but actually a sustained we space? What are the promises and what are the perils?
Oh, big question.
Big question.
So part of it, I think we said earlier, a major factor in it is that people need to be there for a higher purpose. In other words, it's that there has to be something that everyone there shares that's and a commitment to it. So I would say commitment is very a real recognition of or willingness to recognize what the goal is, and a confidence that the goal can be realized both by the individuals and by the group. So and in that a willingness to move past egoic agendas, which is of course where the devil's in the details. So, and the ego is very tricky. So a lot of what arises in let's say spiritual groups, which are the ones that I have the most experience with, are all the kind of hidden agendas of ego. And that means that there needs to be a lot of skill and a lot of willingness to recognize the kind of mirroring, tossing back and forth of mutual projections that goes on wherever a group of people are together. So that part of it, you know, working with the individual egos and with the group ego, because groups also have egos, is where spiritual groups tend to break down, fall apart, devolve. There has to be, a real capacity for invoking higher energies. And there needs to be skillful facilitation. So the thing that I've noticed about spiritual groups, about the ones that I've been involved in, and this is what makes it complicated, is that every spiritual group has the quality of the leader, of the founder.
Mm-hmm.
So it has the qualities of the founder. So, and in general, human beings being who they are, everyone who's the center of a spiritual group has qualities of perfection and qualities of imperfection, and what often happens at critical stages is that the group has unconsciously taken on both the strengths and the blind spots of the leader. So you have a kind of group consciousness that's deeply influenced in a kind of an unconscious way by the character of the leader.
That's so important just by itself, just to reflect back that actually, and it really is part of the obligation, of a spiritual teacher to do their own work and to be constantly doing their own work, because the space, whether it's a love space or whether, underneath the love space, there's kind of, all sorts of fear and kind of ego gaming, or whether it's a kind of an overly ambitious space or whatever the nature of the space is. Right, is in some sense, although we don't want to hold the leader exclusively responsible for it, but in some sense, at least the seeds of it you're suggesting, are rooted in the transmission, both conscious and unconscious, right, of the leader or the teacher in a spiritual context into the space.
Right, exactly. And, and of course, particular leaders tend to attract particular, for want of a better word, I won't say followers and students, in other words, you're attracted to the teacher who, in a certain sense, mirrors what you recognize as spiritual, what you recognize as evolutionary. But you're also attracted to the teacher who, in some way, might mirror your unresolved parental issues, your unresolved karmic issues, if you want to...
Much like the same way we marry people,
exactly. Those
who both kind of speak to our highest selves, but also kind of who invite us to do the unfinished business we might not have finished. So the same attraction to a teacher right, is the attraction we have to a romantic partner because they're both deep love relationships, and the perils and the promise seem to exist in both, you're suggesting.
Exactly. So for example, without mentioning names, in groups that I've touched into over the years, there might be a group which is radically celebratory, you know, in other words, where the positive feeling is huge, and there might also be a reluctance to allow anything into the space that, you know, that might be a bring down. So you have the light, you know, of the wonderful love and celebration. Then you have the shadow of all the, you know, the kind of repressed, you know, darkness that people kind of put out of the spiritual space because they've come to identify spirituality with, you know, with good feelings and celebration.
Right. Or by contrast, and I remember actually at a particular institution that I was involved with many, like 35, 40 years ago, right, where the culture of the institution was cynical.
Yes, and exactly.
You couldn't break through the cynicism. No matter how many good things happened, right, the essential discourse and culture was a kind of cynical discourse, which was very so each of them is a particular shadow. One doesn't allow in celebration, and
right.
The other doesn't allow in kind of a genuine self-reflection because it's thought that somehow love and criticism contradict each other.
Exactly. And, you know, and then you have the organizations that are all about suffering, all about, you know, okay, how are you suffering? And
right.
You know, and
I'm suffering more than you.
Suffering more than you, and I'm more authentic than you because I'm suffering more. And there are organizations that are completely about, you know, what we can, you know, we could call the expansion of the intellect. So there are a lot of really smart people who are not quite comfortable being inarticulate and heartfelt. And there are other organizations where, you know, the heart is so privileged that nobody's willing to engage in intellectual reflection because they find, you know, so that there's so many ways in which an organization's, let's say, undeveloped, you know, the undeveloped qualities of the leader or the group can kind of jam the energy in the we space. It's one of the reasons why I think that self-reflection in a group is as vital and critical as self-reflection in an individual, and rather more difficult.
Right,
you know,
right. And so this is, yeah, and rather more difficult. So this is, you know, to kind of recapitulate as we open up for questions, but we don't have actually that much time left. It's such an utterly delightful and necessary and important, you know, conversation. Right. In order to actually yield and to frame, right, an evolutionary we space, right, you know, what we need to do is we need to, you know, on the one hand, you know, we need to actually balance hierarchy. There needs to be a genuine hierarchy. There needs to be the ability for there to be transmission into the space to at least initiate the space. And at the same time, you know, to open up for the full possibility, you know, of everyone's unique self, you know, emerging. You know, we need to demand that the leader of the group, if there is a leader, right, be doing profound spiritual work. You know, we need to watch for the perils of an organizational, you know, culture, you know, that which emerges, which doesn't allow for the full integral embrace of all the qualities that are needed, right, to create healthy space. You know, and what we see most clearly is that we need we space. We need collective intelligence. We need it desperately. We need it desperately for our realization because we're social animals, and sitting on a mountaintop in Nepal isn't actually our way. Our way is to engage in organizations. It's to engage in we spaces. There's actually no place on the planet today we can actually be by yourself fully alone anymore. You know, Google Earth will find you, meaning, you know, we're forced by a world that's moving closer and closer, right? We live in we spaces. And if we can't evolve our we spaces, we can't actually meet the new life conditions that we have for the planet to survive and flourish, you know, ranging from, as we said, you know, how do we come together in a we space at a meeting, right, to deal with genocide? We haven't, I mean, we haven't figured how to do that at a meeting, you know, of superpowers. So the ability to create an egoless we space, right, isn't just, right, you know, a beautiful experience. It isn't just, right, one of the ways to realization. I mean, it's an utter necessity for both the survival and the flourishing of our planet.
Absolutely, absolutely, and Again, one of the things that in that great list of qualifications for an enlightened re-space that you mentioned, I think we also have to say that there has to be a profound commitment to self-reflection on the part of everyone in the group, whatever it is, which would include, I guess, the participants in the Mideast peace process.
All of it.
So it's, I would say it's perhaps the most important way in which we need to evolve love in our time.
Yeah, maybe that's the sentence. It's really perhaps the most, Sally Kempton, you heard it from Sally, it's perhaps the most important way that we need, to evolve love in our time. So star seven, and Sally, I'm doing my facilitator responsibilities here, so please don't think me rude. I just want to make sure that people can send in questions who want to. We now have about 14 minutes left, so star seven, if you want to unmute and ask a live question, please. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello,
please go ahead. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Shika.
Please.
Thanks. I was wondering if you could clarify for me what you mean when you say ego.
Sally, please.
Okay, great question. So when we're using the word ego here, we're not talking about ego in the in the Freudian psychological sense as the healthy I, although that is certainly a part of it. We're talking about the tendency to identify exclusively with your own body, with your mind, with your opinions, and especially with the ideas about how reality is that come out of your woundedness. I would say...
Let me just repeat back, Chica, just that beautiful sentence from Sally. Ego as the idea about what reality is that come out of your woundedness, and as you said, your separate self.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and especially your wounded separate self, because obviously ego is we need an ego. We need to have a clear sense of self and boundaries and who we are just to keep us from bumping into walls, if nothing else. But it's when the self begins to identify with our distortions, with our wounds, etc., that ego becomes really dangerous.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Chica. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
That help, by the way. Are you? Does that answer clarify for you? I think she unmuted. She muted herself.
We lost you, Chica, but that's okay. Thank you. No, Sally, I will. Yeah, I think it was a beautiful answer, and thank you, Chica. And anyone else, star seven, right, to unmute and to ask a question or to send a question in from the webcast. I know we have a lot of webcast questions. Let me just ask a couple of them. So Arlene M. Zubris from Lynn, M.A., which I think is Maryland or Massachusetts. So I hear references to self as true self, authentic self, evolutionary self. Wilbur refers, Ken to witness, pure consciousness, and of course, spirit. I have a reference of ego, soul, and spirit. Will you please clarify, right, the set of terms? Okay, sure. I think we can do that. Sal, you want to take just to kind of talk to us a little bit about what we mean by true self, right, as opposed to authentic self or evolutionary self. And I think here what Arlene is referring to, right, is the different usages of self that have kind of abounding in the community. As you know, I use unique self, and we've kind of put that into the space. And, true self, in relationship to unique self, right, is one thing. And I don't think we can actually ask Sally to speak to how other people are using the terms. But Sally, do you want to just kind of talk about, how you use the term self and how unique self and true self operate, and then I can perhaps speak to the other terms.
Okay, so in the tradition that I speak from, the word self, which is an Indian tradition, a Hindu-based tradition, the word self or the true self, which is the phrase I'm using in conversation with Mark, because that's a phrase he uses. In my tradition, we just say self with a capital S. The Sanskrit term is Atman, and it means the self which is your, let's say, personal portion of God, which is pure consciousness manifesting through you as you. But this essential self is the self that we tend to experience most easily in meditation or when we're identifying with pure awareness. In other words, that this essential self or true self is the self which knows itself to be consciousness and does not identify with the thoughts and feelings and sensations that arise inside that space of consciousness. So it's very much a meditated indrawn space, although as we've been saying, it occurs in group as well. I'm going to ask Mark to talk about unique self, because that's the term it's a term that he has studied and taught about a great deal. I'll just say that when we're talking about unique self, at least in this conversation, we're talking about true self, that essential self, consciousness itself, expressing itself through speech, expressing itself through actions in the very unique individual way that each human being expresses that God self.
And precisely and beautifully. I mean, yes, 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 yes. And I would just add, Arlene, just to clarify in terms of your specific question, right? Basically what both myself and Ken, as we developed unique self, I first coined the term some 20 years ago, but as we developed this idea of unique self and in many conversations with Dan Hamilton, with Sally, who's with us on the phone, the essential movement, and it's actually coming out actually as a book in about 10 months, a book called Unique Self, The Future of Enlightenment, which I wrote, which Ken wrote the introduction to. What we're basically pointing to is that beyond pure consciousness and beyond witness, there's a unique expression of pure consciousness, a unique expression of witness. And perhaps it's even better to say not even beyond pure consciousness, but actually, right, when you actually realize the deepest nature of pure consciousness, you realize that it has a unique perspective. You realize that the seamless code of the universe is seamless but not featureless. So we realize that the end game, right, is not what has sometimes been referred to as classical enlightenment, but that actually there's something beyond that, which actually the traditions themselves intuited, right, and spoke about in various ways, and we're kind of fully explicating that strain in the tradition. We don't actually end at the place that we realize we're part of the one. We then go deeper and realize we're a unique expression of the one with an evolutionary responsibility, right? So the unique self is the unique expression, right, of your true self. The total number of true selves is one. But there are billions of unique expressions, right, of the unique self, right, and that's where your full authenticity and your evolutionary obligation, right, come on board. Now, Andrew Cohen and myself have dialogued about the difference between unique and authentic self, and I won't go into that dialogue now. I would just say that the core of the difference is that for Andrew, authentic self is an awakened impersonal function, right? It's ultimately you realize your true self, right, and then out of your true self, this enormous surge of impulse to activism and action and creativity emerges, which is an impersonal function, which is, of course, deeply correct and true. What I've emphasized, right, is that impersonal function is uniquely expressed, right, in every individual whose consciousness is clarified. And Sally, if I can, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, now you've often cited from your teacher, Muktananda, God appears in you as you, which you and I have talked many times about what he's talking about, but certainly that's possible to interpret that, right, as an invitation to unique self. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think...
I would say that one of the things that we've said in this dialogue that I found interesting and a perspective that I hadn't actually looked at before in terms of group, is that it's possible for a group to enter into, that the essential state of consciousness, of pure consciousness, all the individuals just kind of entering into consciousness itself and being experiencing their true self in the group, and that then there's a that then the group can in a brilliant evolutionary move, kind of come into a sort of waking consciousness and dialogue as full expressions of their unique individuality, yet totally held in the shared essential space of, you know, of the great self.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And please, am I interrupting? Do I have one more sentence there?
No, that's it.
No, please, beautiful. So before we run out of time, so Deborah, we have a few more questions. Deborah from Ashland asks, right, Sally, is there a way to participate in this kind of collective we in an ongoing community in your organization now? And Sally, it seems like your telecourses actually create this very, very deep space. I know that there's many, many people participating in them. Do you have actually one of those telecourses coming up?
I do actually. I have one starting on Wednesday. It's called Freeing the Mind, and it's part of a series that I do called Transformative Practice Journey. In this one, we'll actually be looking at what it is to have an enlightened mind and how to work with your stories and your stuff.
And if I want to sign up, how do I do that?
You go to my website.
SallyKempton.com, right?
.com. You click on the top-down menu. You click on under events, and you go to schedule, and there's a sign-up there. The class starts on Wednesday, September 8th, and it's a teleconference. It's three successive Wednesdays, and there is actually one of the main qualities of these teleconferences is that there is a very genuine we space that's created, not just on the teleconference itself, but a community forms around the dialogues that take place on the listserv, and it's a very satisfying ongoing experience of community, which I have to say I love it myself. It's something that has simply emerged over the course of a couple of years of these teleconference communities forming. I almost feel as though it has nothing to do with me. It is the formation of a genuine we space
Formation of a genuine we space, but to say that it has nothing to do with you, I'm going to have to politely, right, and lovingly object. As we talked earlier, there is, right, both a kind of hierarchical transmission, as you said yourself earlier. So I would just, disagree with Sally. I apologize, Sally, for doing that. But actually, Sally's presence, and I've heard from many, many people who participate over the last couple of years in these calls, Sally's presence and Shakti and transmission creates a space in these calls that people say that are on them that is just kind of out of this world. So I just want to repeat again, right, you can go to SallyKempton.com, and there's a course, if I heard correctly, starting this coming Wednesday, September, whatever this coming Wednesday, 7th or 8th, but this coming Wednesday.
And you can sign up for it. You can do it live, or you can download it as an MP3,
Fantastic.
What a lot of
people. And you look on the menu bar under events, and then you look for schedule.
Yes.
Perfect. That's excellent. And, right, in the kind of, church announcements, you always have church announcements, in a collective we space. So also, please don't forget to join us live on the Future of Love teleseries on Saturday, September 18th. There'll be a special Q&A session with our colleague and good friend Diane Mutual-Hamilton, with Sally Kempton, with myself, Mark Goffney, right, about Integral Spiritual Experience 2. Sally, Dan, and myself are the design group for Integral Spiritual Experience 2, which is on the Future of Love, and we'll be there to answer whatever questions you have about this upcoming New Year's event. The event is rapidly filling up. There's about, at this point, there must be, 300-400 people signed up already, with another 50 to 75 people, on staff. So there's not a ton of spaces left. So please, to invite you to be with us and talk about an evolutionary we space. I mean, Sally, we were both there last year. I mean, just completely, completely awesome evolutionary we space with just, fantastic teachers. Who's going to be with us this year, Sally? Deepak Chopra, Warren Farrell, Daphne Rose Kingman, Joan Borisenko, our friend, good friend Arjuna, fabulous integral teachers Samuel and Linda, Vijayadeva will be there with us. Who else?
Junpo Kelly, who's a
Junpo
wonderful...
Junpo Kelly, right. Zen teacher. There's just an incredible, incredible cast of characters of just, beautiful spiritual teachers, fantastic people. So that is actually the evolutionary we space. And, right, our fantastic, team of curators, Kelly Sozin-Bear and Nicole Fegley, right, tell us to join live September 18th, also because they'll be picking then one lucky winner from the call to win a free ticket to attend ISC 2 and a second free ticket to bring a friend. Now, that's fantastic. That's completely awesome, right? You can't offer just one free ticket to the Future of Love. You have to offer two, right? But you can't win, right? They write in their message, right, if you're not live on the call with us. Okay, so everyone hear that. Be live on the call on September 18th, right, to win one or two free tickets to the Future of Love, right? So really, really welcome to everyone. And finally, you know, you're completely invited to join Sally and I, right, at Esalen, right, on October 8th or 9th. We're going to have a fantastic event, right, at Esalen, which will be another evolutionary We space, which will be completely, you know, beautiful and awesome. And our colleague Diane Mushel-Hamilton will be teaching at Kripalu in November. And so really just take a look at the iEvolve website, right, and you'll see just an incredible amount of just beautiful teaching and, you know, really an evolution of spiritual teaching and spiritual community and spiritual teachers, which is just humbling and delightful, you know, and beautiful. And so at this moment, you know, Sally, I want to just thank you so much for being with us. You know, we got, you know, many more questions came in that we didn't have time to handle. But just the elegance and grace of your just presence and transmission has just, you know, been delightful on this call and for all of us at Integral Spiritual Experience and iEvolve. And, of course, in all of, you know, your teaching, you know, in the yoga world, you know, your Yoga Journal column is just a delight and an honor for all of us. So thank you very, very, very much.
And I'd like to thank you, Mark, for being such a master of creating We Spaces.
Yeah.
It's a total delight to dialogue with you.
Yeah, no. Thank you. Thank you, Sally. Amen. And to everyone listening, you know, we're just going to finish with a couple of quotations which really capture what Sally was pointing us to. You know, the ancient unique self-mystics of the Kabbalah called about the Shekhinah, which speaks to the voice of the teacher. Right? They said that whenever 10 people gather with clear holy intention, the Shekhinah speaks. Or as Matthew said, when two or three gather in my name, I am in the midst of them. Or as Hindu mystic Aurobindo said, the evolution of truth consciousness, in which they feel themselves to be the embodiment of a single self. Ralph Waldo Emerson, all are conscious of attaining to a higher self, possession it shines for all. You know, and these are just beautiful intimations.
Uh-huh.
And Craig gathered him these quotes in his article on collective intelligence. And one of the things that we teachers are doing is creating a collective We space of generosity, where that you can actually study with a primary teacher, right, with two teachers together, where teachers are actually creating among themselves, perhaps for the first time in history, right, a collective We space of teachers, right, of generosity and honor. You know, and let that be a blessing. Thank you, everyone, for being with Sally Kempton. Right, be with us with her on her telecourse beginning this coming Wednesday, sallykempton.com. Be with us at the Future of Love and have the most beautiful, delightful day in the world. Thank you, Sally. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Mark.